Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, Dr. Martin Luther King Day, the 17th of January. We talk about end-of-life care this hour of the program when someone you love is in the final stages of life. Conversations about the end of life can be extremely difficult, extremely emotional, and yet talking about end-of-life care is important on many different fronts. You might be able to help your loved one make important end-of-life decisions, and there are so many to be made. How do you navigate the medical system, whether or not your loved one should remain at home, or what about nursing homes or other facilities? When should you seek hospice care? What if the loved one who is dying does not want hospice care? And how you can deal with the healthcare team to help make certain that everyone, particularly your loved one, is comfortable during end of life. We have two guests with us this hour of the program, Professor Betty Kramer. Professor Betty Kramer is professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her interests are aging, family conflict at end of life, family caregiving in later life families, innovations in end-of-life care, social work's role in improving the care of the dying. Her research has strengthened understanding of male caregivers, caregiving gains, transitions in the caregiving career, and the distinctive nature of end-of-life caregiving. Professor Betty Kramer, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Also joining us is Professor Dr. Stacy Fisher, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Healthcare Policy and Research at the University of Colorado. She has an interesting background. She worked in Central and South America in an underserved hospital in Peru, and she became interested in how culture and socioeconomic deprivation affect healthcare, specifically care at the end of life. She's involved in teaching now medical students and residents, and she is board certified in internal medicine, geriatrics, and hospice palliative care. And her recent work includes being at the seniors' clinic at the Westside Family Health Center, which is a community-based clinic, part of the Denver Health Medical Center. Dr. Fisher, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Dr. Kramer, let's start with you, and we'll hear both of your responses to this. This remains a very difficult area for everybody to talk about, the end of life. Maybe it's because we still deny death in this society, but there is so much that we need to know: what somebody's wishes are, what the healthcare situation is, Medicare, Medicaid, nursing home expenses, all of that. It's just something that we need to think about in our lifetime. Why is it so darn hard for us to do that? Dr. Kramer?
Well, I think that we, you know, as you say, as a society, we tend to have an aversion to thinking about or talking about death. And, you know, I really encourage the general public as much as possible to really embrace this idea that, in fact, 100% of the population will die.
Yeah, right.
It's a very natural process. It's something that happens to all living things. And the more we can kind of keep that in mind, it can shift how we live our lives, how we communicate with one another. A lot of people who are traumatized when someone dies are traumatized because, you know, it comes as such a shock. Like, how could this have happened to me? Why me? You know?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the most natural thing in the world. And so the more we can prepare for that, be aware of it, you know, it can change how we live and how we think and how prepared we are for the actual death that when it arrives. This is, you know, it's never an easy thing. So I think just normalizing the dying process as a society is something that would help us tremendously. And it used to be much more that way in the early part of the century when, you know, we didn't have a lot of technology to keep us alive. And so, you know, doctors would go out to the homes and talk with people about an illness and explain that this was a natural process, and they would encourage people to communicate and share their love. And, you know, it was much more, you know, children could see the dying process, and we've really tucked people away into institutions and created this really scary environment, and it's unnecessary.
Dr. Fisher, your thoughts on this?
Well, just to build a little bit on what Dr. Kramer was saying, you know, back, you know, at the turn of the century, people, meaning the 1900s, people were dying of infectious diseases primarily. And so now people are living with chronic severe illness for years before the end of life. And having those conversations and starting to talk about it as part of the routine care and fully integrated into the care of those chronic complex medical conditions, I think would help normalize it more. And there's emerging evidence that this is indeed the case, and that can then improve the quality of the end-of-life experience.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your work, Dr. Fisher, in Peru, and whether or not we're looking at very deep cultural differences here. Is there a greater acceptance, do you find, among people who you serve there of dying? Or is it that there aren't very many resources, as many resources, to keep people alive at all costs?
Well, I think that is certainly the case. I think the problems that the society in the United States is facing is certainly one of plenty. We have all these technologies, we have all these interventions, and that we can do this. And most of the world, obviously, that's not available to people at the end of life, and death is much more a part of their daily lives because of that.
Yeah, and if could I interject?
Yeah, of course.
Comment here too. It also strikes me that the medical profession, as we've developed specialists around different forms of illness and disease, that medical professionals are really trained to treat those diseases. And so there's a focus on active treatment. And as a result, you know, doctors are doing everything they can to treat disease and do what they can. And, you know, it's interesting, there was a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that reported that doctors often fail to acknowledge the final stages of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia as a terminal illness. And this, what this means for us is that patients are often subjected to really invasive procedures rather than comfort care, because doctors are trained to employ these technologies. And so they aren't, you know, going to families and saying, you know, your family member has Alzheimer's disease, this is a terminal illness, this is what you can expect to happen. You know, so it's a real dilemma. Mm-hmm. Families are waiting for doctors to talk with them, to have the conversations, and it's not generally happening.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, as a practicing palliative care physician, we get referrals from other specialists in the hospitals to see their patients and to help provide palliative care. And we can talk a little bit more about what palliative care is in a moment. But what we find is that the oncologist or the cardiologist will say, well, whatever you do, don't mention hospice. Tell them it's a place where you can go and do crafts.
Oh,
and
my.
So there's still this shroud around things, and that the physicians themselves, as well as the patients and families, are just unwilling to face the possibility that this is really representing end of life.
What is palliative care?
Palliative care is a board-certified medical specialty that really focuses on symptom management and quality of life for patients that are facing life-limiting illness. We work as the palliative care specialty, or palliative care team, is a interdisciplinary team. We work with nurses, social work, chaplains to help patients and families with complex medical decision-making, working on their goals, values, and preferences, and ensuring that the care that they're receiving is meeting those goals and preferences.
Mm-hmm. There's also just so much information, I've found this to be true, that we don't know very much about when we're caring for a loved one, for a parent, a relative, a dear friend, concerning end of life and what, you know, what, quite frankly, it's the last thing you want to worry about is money issues. But there are a lot of money issues involved with all of this, too, whether or not you're going to be in a nursing home, how many days you have, if you're on Medicare, what's Medicaid, what is hospice, who pays for that. It really is, and you don't want to have to concern yourself with all of that. So it's probably something you should know about before you find yourself in that position, isn't it? Just for everybody's well-being.
Yeah, I think that's true. The reality is that we often don't think about the financial aspect of this, and the financial costs of care can be really challenging. And you know, there are different services. You know, my mother died in November, and she was diagnosed in September with advanced cancer, and it was quite a journey even for my family to figure out, you know, what she could receive. And of course, her oncologist was encouraging her to do active aggressive treatment, right? She had stage 4 cancer. And because I know something about this, I was questioning, well, excuse me, why would we do that? And what would we accomplish? And I finally convinced everyone to have these discussions about, well, what is the likely, what is likely to happen if we follow through with radiation and chemotherapy, and what does that mean for quality of life, and what are the services that are available, and how will these be paid for? And and my mother, you know, bless her heart, she decided to enroll in hospice when she realized that the treatments were going to not really help her quality of life. And then we, you know, she realized that with hospice care, she would also, they would pay for, because, you know, it's a Medicare benefit, it would provide a hospital bed to bring into the home. It would pay for all of her pain medication, which was huge. There were many, financial savings for her to enroll in hospice and get the kind of care she needed and the support that she could get in the home. To do that. But yeah, it's not a conversation in my family we had until we were really faced with this.
Yes. And what about if the loved one wants nothing to do with hospice?
Well, one of the limitations of hospice, and I think hospice has really changed the way we die, and so I'm not disparaging it in any way, but I do want to clarify that some of the eligibility for hospice limits patients being able to use it. And specifically what I mean is that it does all these wonderful things, but what you can't do is continue to seek aggressive treatment towards the focus at the disease.
Yes.
So for some, that means that they're not interested in hospice care. And so something like palliative care, which encompasses hospice but is not exclusive to hospice, can come in and then provide some of the symptom management and working towards the medical decision-making, helping give support to patients and families while still working with the oncologist and allowing the patients to still seek curative care. And Medicare does cover palliative care.
See, I don't think most of us even know about that, that we just don't know what's there, which is terrible.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a real challenge.
There was a recent report from the Center to Advance Palliative Care that really looked nationwide at what is the access nationwide of palliative care. And overall, there are many communities that don't have any access to palliative care, especially in rural places and smaller hospitals, and many states that don't. That have very, very limited access.
Mm. But there is a growing movement nationally too. We've had a huge increase in palliative care programs nationally. So they, you know, now there are many major hospitals across the country and, you know, mid-sized large cities that have palliative care programs, and people just really need to, a lot of times they may learn about them when they enter a hospital for some health event. But again, it depends on whether or not the physician is willing to refer to the palliative care service.
Mm-hmm.
So if families know about it, they can ask, is there a palliative care program here at the hospital? Or where can I find, you know, information on a local palliative care service? Is there one in the area?
Yes. Tell me, because you lost your mom so recently, and I'm sorry, that's a hard loss. I could fully understand that one. Where did your mom die? Was she at home? Did you have a plan, you and your siblings, of what you wanted to have happen, and it was a peaceful death for her?
Well, she had a great deal of pain, and her plan was to go to my sister's home, and I and my 4 siblings were going to provide care for her, 24-hour care, and we rotated. Each of us took a day of the week, and the system was working fine for a week. We got in-home hospice. They came out and brought a bed and gave us medications and whatnot, but we were still having trouble getting her pain managed. She had, bone involvement and, you know, all throughout her body. And so they ended up inviting her to go to the inpatient hospice unit to get her, try to get her symptoms managed better. And she just eventually, you know, it just was sometimes, you know, with complex forms of, you know, disease, it can be very difficult to manage the pain. But they eventually did get her pain managed, and she lived, you know, not too much longer in the inpatient hospice unit. But, you know, we felt like she got very good care, and we all were able to do what we needed to do. And yeah, so anyway, there's a lot more to it. My brother-in-law had a heart attack in the midst of it all.
Oh, my goodness.
And this is real life. This is what happens to
family. Oh, yes.
Things happen, and, you know, you just try to do the very best you can. You remind one another, look, we're going to get through this. We love each other. Let's do the best we can. And it's you know, not going to last forever, and we want to do right by Mom. So we really did pull together, and we were very fortunate. Not all families have that. Not all families have that support and that, you know, ability to work collaboratively.
Right. Well, a lot of families live, let's go to you on this, Dr. Fisher, so far apart from each other that and are unable to come and spend time to be with their loved one as they're going through the final stages of life. So it's building a support system in that regard is a difficult thing to do.
Absolutely. There are models of sharing, share the care is one, where they really rally all the community support, all the people that are around, neighbors, friends, relatives that want to help but just don't know exactly how to do it. And there are actually frameworks, and you can find this on the internet, and I can send you a website for the listeners, where they can build a framework for support so that they're covering meals and covering you know, sitting with the loved one who's ill and helping clean the house and doing all these kinds of things, but putting it in a structured way so that all those people that are well-intentioned that want to help know exactly what to do. This is your task.
Mm.
And that can create some of the family networks that have been lost because of the way we live now.
And how do you do that? Share the Care? It's a special program?
Share the Care is one of them. But I believe there are other models out there as well that provide a framework for these caregiving networks.
Okay, send us, and we'll put that on our Facebook page. So
absolutely.
Send that to us, and we'll be very happy to put that on the page. The other thing that I found to be difficult about all of this, it's not necessarily difficult, but we're in a society where we want to know things. And dying can take its own time sometimes. It's not something that you may know your terminal, but you may live for quite some time. And as a caregiver, it's hard to plan what kind of health care you're going to have because you're not sure what your time frame is here.
I think that's true. And I think some of the more specific questions of do you want this or do you want that and the menu of checkboxes that we can sometimes see in some of the advanced care planning documents sometimes can be a little less helpful. We can always, as a physician, I can always come up with a scenario that doesn't quite fit into whatever directive a patient has completed. However, when families, patients, caregivers, health professionals are able to sit down and start talking about broader discussions about what's really important to them in their life, what makes their life worth living, what do they value above all else, and then understanding those kinds of values and preferences more broadly, then it's easier to make medical decisions in the future based on, you know, what are the likely outcomes? What is the treatment offering for quality of life? What's most important? We have patients that will say, I want quantity. I want to live, even if this treatment only offers me a day or two of additional life, I want that treatment.
Mm. What do most people want? Do they fall into that category or a category of, I understand this is terminal, I just want to be peaceful, don't do treatment on me?
Generally people don't want suffering. So that
they don't want, you know, pain, sure.
Yeah, people don't want pain, they don't want suffering, they don't want it for themselves and they don't want it for their family members. So even if people want aggressive treatment, they don't want suffering. And that's one of the reasons why the palliative care programs are so important and why we need to do a better job training physicians in general about how to keep people comfortable. And people often will say they want to be able to be at home. They want to be able to die at home, or they might want their family with them. but it's just very individual. You know, we have several studies have been done that look even at cultural differences, and you know, many African Americans tend to want more aggressive treatment, partly from the history of discrimination that they experienced and the atrocities that were inflicted upon them in research studies, and you know, they want to feel like they're getting everything they can get from the medical system to keep them alive so that their lives are perceived of value.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have several online already. We're talking about end-of-life issues this hour of our program. Dr. Betty Kramer in the School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is with us, and Dr. Stacy Fisher, Assistant Professor of Medicine in Healthcare Policy and Research at the University of Colorado. They are both specialists in the areas of end-of-life care and all that encompasses, and that's a lot. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Ron Reagan will be with us, the son of the president, who's written a totally engaging book, My Father at 100. Ron went to many places in Illinois where the Reagan family lived. They traveled all over Dixon, Galena, that whole area, and met people who had rebuilt the houses and the apartments that the Reagans lived in. And he spent a lot of time also researching the Irish history and talks about the discussions and the disagreements that he had with his father about a number of issues. So Ron Reagan is with us tomorrow at 10. We go to phone calls for our guest. Steve in Hudson is our first caller, Dr. Kramer and Dr. Fisher. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, man, this is such a huge and utterly consuming process. One thing I didn't expect, I mean, apart from, you know, if you don't know what to do, you can't ask. My father was, he's had heart failure and suffering from dementia and really refused to be moved to a place. And he lived by himself until about 3 months ago.
Mm.
And we would bring him meals and take care of him and all that. But then he suffered kind of a trauma and he ended up in the ER. And from there, he's in the hospital, and then they whisked him to a long-term care facility, which we were told we had to refer to as a rehabilitation center. Couldn't say nursing home, couldn't say hospice or anything like that. So he's there, and he's comfortable, and he's getting good care. The thing we didn't anticipate was just the stress on the rest of the family. We have a family business, and some siblings that don't get along so well, and it's been really, really difficult. My advice is to anyone who, you know, is going to be part of this senior tsunami that's coming, we're going to need more of this care, is to work out your problems now.
Hmm.
Get any needed therapy. resolve any conflicts you may have with family to straighten all this out, because these are not easy decisions you're going to have to be making. And if there's personal matters, our family's pretty close to where my father is located. So it's not like, you know, we're across the country or anything. So we can actually drive over and visit him relatively frequently. So we've got that going for us. But it's the other stuff you got to work out. And it may not be completely obvious at first.
Yeah, Steve, I really appreciate your sharing your experience. And I'm sorry, I know how difficult it must be, and it becomes so challenging at the end of life because of the emotional intensity of, you know, facing the death of a loved one or facing the demands of care at the end of life that are really intense. And we know that the strongest predictor, the most powerful predictor of conflict at end of life is a history of conflict or difficulties, interpersonal difficulties in the family. And so, and we also know that that leads to complicated bereavement. It makes it much more difficult to heal after the death. And so your words of wisdom are really well taken, that to the extent that, you know, we can all just realize, wow, you know, life is short. What can we do to try to heal what's going on in the family? Am I willing to say, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry if I ever hurt you. You know, these kinds of things. We aren't generally encouraged to do that, but it's of such value.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing how intense all and everything is just right there, and it's so crucial the kind of care your loved one will get. Maybe one sibling, if the loved one isn't clear about what he or she wants, you can have huge debates about what kind of care your parents should have, and have completely different ideas about it. And oh, it just rips. It can rip you apart, can't it? It's just very hard.
I think that's a very powerful argument for really establishing who is the decision maker, who is the person best able to speak on behalf of the patient, and being able to select that person for yourself can help minimize those conflicts later.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you can fall back on, well this is what mom wanted.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and I'd just add to that too, that if at all possible, it is really smart to try to bring the family together earlier to have these conversations so that everyone is on the same page. Because what often happens is that someone will say, I want my daughter to, you know, be the decision maker, but no one ever really talks about that or why, the reasons, or what the wishes are. And so at the end of life, when all this stuff is bubbling and there's a lot of strain, and the daughter steps up to fulfill her role, and then the others might feel resentful, like, why, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, and you can create this. So this idea of trying to express your wishes as broadly as possible to as many family members as are going to be involved in the process later is really important.
Mm-hmm. Did that happen, Steve, in your family? Is there a decision maker?
Yeah, we had an advanced care directive, and yeah, there was a little bit of resentment about who was chosen. I mean, my parents did it based on location. They just chose a person, my brother, who lived the closer to the house. But you got to come together earlier, and because life is so relentless. Most of us live these days within such tightly scripted lives with no margins for anything to come up.
Yes, very true.
It's just an extra complication and difficulty, and things like my mother passed away 3-4 years ago, and she had very rapidly progressing cancer. And as that with cancer, you lose an ability to metabolize food, and so we had the whole feeding tube discussion, and we were split on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right on the heels of the whole Terry Schiavo stopping Congress, you know, skipping. George Bush left vacation to stop Congress for that. And so that didn't, you know, that kind of totally underscored all that. But our family is pretty lucky in that, you know, my sister's a medical professional. I'm a software engineer. My other two siblings are very intelligent. So they could kind of be a little more analytical about it and not quite as emotional. And so with my father, we were kind of prepared. But it's all the other stuff you got to figure out. You got to kind of bang people's heads together and say, children, you know, get it together.
Yes. Oh, well, Steve, I'm so glad you called. Best of luck with your siblings and with your father.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And what he says is true, that you need the help of other people because, as he said, our lives are so tightly scripted to take care, as I'm sure you know, very, very recently, Dr. Kramer, that this is can be incredibly consuming, not only of your physical time, but also of your emotional energy, et cetera. If you've got children yourself, and many do, and you have a job, and it's just, it's a bit much to have to handle. It can be absolutely overwhelming.
Yeah, really, I remember talking with my siblings about, it's like we're in a pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
We're either going to explode or we're going to let the steam out carefully. And yeah, and I have children. I was traveling down to Illinois to do my part, you know, many, many, many trips back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, a lot of it was, you know, when I could see tensions rising. One morning I got to the house and my brother-in-law was really stressed, and I could tell he was, you know, kind of agitated that I hadn't gotten there earlier, even though it was, you know, he had said, come whenever you can. And then I realized that things had changed for my mom, and my sister was up all night with her, and then she had to go to work. She got no sleep and then had to go to work because her workplace wasn't accommodating. And so these stressors that, you know, the way I responded was, oh, I'm so sorry. You know, we're going to need to look at another plan. We need more help. Let's figure this out. And I really care about you. Let me know how I can help. And so, you know, kind of going, sometimes what happens is if there's these tensions because the family's stressed, the reaction is to lash out. And the more skillful approach is to try to have compassion and to say, oh, my goodness, this is really hard. What can we do? You know, how can I help you, and how can we work together better? I really care about you. So, but, yeah, it can be very intense. It is like a pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good description of it. Let's go to Polly from Two Rivers next. Hi, Polly.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning, Polly.
I am a registered nurse, and I happen to work in a long-term care facility, and I was listening to Steve very intently with his story. And it kind of reminds me that when we're in work, the nurses, we talk a lot about care of the elderly. And, of course, in a facility, we have a rehab unit, so most of those people go home. But we have people in wellness and right up to giving either hospice or palliative care. And what we talk about a lot is that people don't seem to think about what the meaning of death is in terms of life and how it is a process of a part of a life situation. And I guess we're all going to die. And I think a lot of people are not prepared for death. And a lot of people don't think about it. Even we recently had a lady that was in hospice. And when she died, the family was not prepared. We didn't have a funeral home. And they always wanted to have extra care. You know, they always talked about hospitalizing her. So we used to, you know, talk about her specifically, that the family didn't get how ill she was and what kind of care she received.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Fisher, let's start with you.
I think that's a really important point, and I think the research would show that the more we can have these end of life discussions, the more helpful it is for patients, and to realize that they are terminally ill, and then to ensure that they're able to express their preferences. And what we know from the research is that when patients are able to express their preferences, when they've had these end of life discussions, that they are more likely to receive that their care that's consistent with their preferences at the end of life. So I think kind of continuing to have these talks, and we see that quite often in the hospital when caring for patients, is that the perception of what we think we've said and the perception of what family members or patients may have heard may be very different. And so to make it an ongoing dialogue, I think, is the most helpful to get people onto the same page.
Thank you, Polly, for your call. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Eugene.
Benjamin Franklin and I got along pretty good. We both turned another year older today.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, I turned 72, and I was talking to my brother last night in Baraboo, and he said, yep. He said, 72 bottles of beer on the wall. I said, well, I got over that one many, many years ago. But this gave me a reflection on what's coming up. I may have 10 or 15 years ahead of me. So what I have started to do, I do my blood tests about every 6 months. And I've started to take pretty good care of myself, and I watch the little things. And if something is going wrong, I get up to the VA up to Tomah. And as a result, I've kept my blood pressure and everything under control. But I think one of the things, maybe I live alone. I have a son and I have two brothers living in Baraboo and Reedsburg. But I don't want to burden them with anything as I get older. And I am trying to just take care of myself. And what I see in the younger generation is the quality and the type of food they eat catches up with them as they get older, when they get into their 50s and 60s. And I think I was very fortunate. I grew up right after World War II, and my lunch from late spring until late fall would come out of the garden. I'd get some radish, potatoes, some carrots, and wash them off in the water tank and go. And may the good Lord help me if my mother caught me in a strawberry patch in June. But it's called taking care of yourself when you're younger. You're not going to live forever, but do those medical tests as you get older.
Yeah, thanks, Eugene. Dr. Kramer.
Yeah, you know, one thing I just wanted to mention, I think what Jean mentioned was really important, that a lot of people do feel that they don't want to be a burden to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel like they need to take care of themselves and they need to provide their own care for themselves. And to the extent that that's possible, that's great. But the flip side I just want to share with listeners is that, you know, once we die, our family members are left to kind of deal with that. And the extent to which they felt they did everything they could to do right by their family member often will leave them feeling less challenged in the grief process. So, you know, I know early on I had a conversation with my mother. She was fiercely independent and didn't want any of us to help her. And it made it very difficult to help her. And eventually I said to her, you know, Mom, we all love you. And if we sit back and watch you suffer and not help you, this is going to be awful for us after you die.
Hmm.
We'll never be able to forgive ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So please, let us do what we can to make your life more comfortable. So, and it really helped. It really helped to have that conversation. So, you know, to the extent we can, it is hard to accept help. But if it's needed, there is some benefit on the other side in terms of bereavement.
Thank you for the call. After working in this area for so long and having had personal experience with a loved one dying, do both of you think that we need some brand new model of how we should care for people as they're dying? Are we off in some areas of the care, Dr. Fisher?
Well, I think we have a model that is able to work and provide very good care when we use it, when we access it. And I think the palliative care model can provide that. And so specifically, and as an example, there was a recent study published that looked at patients that presented with metastatics, meaning it had spread outside the lungs, lung cancer. And these patients, half of them received palliative care along with their usual oncology care, and half received just their oncology care. And what the study showed was that the patients that did receive palliative care along with their traditional oncology care had better quality of life, had better symptom control, and for the family members, it was also particularly helpful. And what was very interesting about this is that the patients who got the palliative care along with their usual oncology care actually lived longer.
Hmm.
And so I think we have a model out there that's able to work. The problem is we really need some policy changes to increase access.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that.
And usually the one thing I want to add to that is that usually with palliative care, you also have access to a social worker or someone else on the team who can work with the family to help the family better manage what they're doing and help them understand what resources might be available to support them. You know, and that's something that you don't typically get if you're just working directly with a physician providing treatment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's such an important point. I'm actually, when we're finished with this call, I'm going to meet my team, and we have a chaplain, we work with a social worker, we have advanced practice nurses, and together we're able to really provide care for the whole person, including the family.
And spiritual needs, which
exactly.
Which also are very large, right?
Yeah, when people are facing, you know, really serious illness, spiritual issues, you know, about meaning in life and, you know, why is this happening? And all sorts of questions arise that can often cause great suffering for people. And so having an avenue to assess that and explore it is really valuable, another
mm-hmm.
valuable aspect of palliative care.
Mm-hmm. I've also found that having an avenue to just talk about your life, too, is very important. I found that in my family, that my parents really wanted to talk about, for the first time, World War II with my dad and just, you know, life in the business world and the depression and just this great outpouring of life. It was, those moments were wonderful. But I think he wasn't alone in that a lot of people want to do that, I think.
I think that that's very true. And it really offers a legacy gift for those people who are left behind.
Yes.
Not only for the patient who can experience their own memories or their own life review, but then for those loved ones to have something tangible that they've talked about. And some of these stories come out that, that family members have never heard before.
Right. Yeah, important to everybody. Here's an email that's come in from Eric. I'm in the process of working with the hospice community using ethical wills as a legacy, too. Are you familiar with the use of ethical wills as a tool in end-of-life care? Is anybody familiar with that?
I've heard of them. I have, yeah. Stacey?
I think I have the same. I've heard of them. It's not something we're doing with our palliative care service. We're working more with life review.
Okay. Well, Eric, send us a note. I'm sorry you didn't call so you could tell us more about it.
But it's really related to preserving your legacy of values that is kind of, you know, reminiscent of what you were talking about.
Mm. Uh-huh. Yeah. In another email from Bev, I'm in the middle of this issue with my mother who lives 500 miles away. She has no relatives nearby and no close friends. I'm encouraging her to move into assisted living in my area. She is 89 years old. We've talked about end-of-life issues and have all her wishes in place. The problem is how to make the break from her home of 50-plus years to a community where I am her support system. She seems to be depressed at the thought of moving and yet depressed being alone where she is.
Oh, yeah, how challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is just, you know, I just think, you know, if it were me, I would just be inclined to just go and visit and just sit and have a heart-to-heart about it, just all the pros and cons and then in the end, really respecting mother's wishes. That's important. I think a lot of times we feel compelled to, some families, and I don't get the sense this is happening here, but some families actually enter into this coercion about what they want mom or dad to do. And it's really, you know, from the perspective of the elder and their own autonomy and their rights and all of that, it can be really harmful. But to have conversations about the future and about the current situation from a place of love and, you know, concern. And I remember I said to my mom, look, I want what you want. You help me understand what's important to you. And we will work, I promise you, we will do everything we can to facilitate that. And, you know, but at least you have the conversation and, you know, you go from there. And there's pros and cons both ways.
Yeah. We'll continue our conversation, end-of-life care, this hour of the program. Our guests are Dr. Betty Kramer, professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. Stacey Fisher, assistant professor of medicine, healthcare policy, and research at the University of Colorado. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Wendy in Green Bay. Hello, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi.
I really appreciate you guys doing this show because this is such an important subject. I'm 45 and have been chronically ill with scleroderma for 20-some years and have family all across the country, but no one in the state. And our family is facing, how do we get me moved to one of the other states with trying to transfer over all the benefits? No one knows. And who do you work with when you have a social worker that's absolutely bombed with people and doesn't have the time or resources to dedicate towards, you know, an individual? And our family's just spinning trying to figure out what to do when, you know, each state is kind of crashing with funding being, you know, removed, et cetera. Where do you go when you're all by yourself and you're sick when your family's spread out all throughout the United States?
Wendy, where do you want to move to another state?
Yes,
okay.
But we don't know how to do it.
I see. And what state? Do you know?
Either Illinois or Oregon.
Okay. Yeah. Who do you talk to? How do you make this happen? Dr. Kramer?
Oh, goodness. So you currently have a social worker that you're working with? Is that what you're saying?
There is a social worker. She just doesn't have the time to dedicate towards this subject.
And is there a supervisor or something in the organization where she's employed?
What we're finding is that the supervisor keeps getting replaced by new ones.
Oh.
So they must be having problems.
Yeah. Huh. So your main challenge right now is trying to figure out how to transfer your health care benefits to another state? Is that it?
Yes.
Huh.
Because for each state, it seems to be different.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, and what is your benefit?
Medicare, Social Security, disability. And we're also hearing that each state wants you to form, like, a residency where I've lived on my own for, like, 6 months prior to applying for benefits.
Uh-huh. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm only 45, and we're thinking I need to get closer to family. But how do you do that when no one can explain how to transfer anything so that you can make that move happen?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Yeah. So, and I'm a gerontologist. So, you know, like in for older adults, I'd refer people to the aging and long-term care ombudsman or something, you know, to kind of address these issues. And I'm just not sure in your specific situation who you would call.
Well, that could be a start, and they could always refer her. Aging and long-term care
ombudsman. Program. Yeah.
Okay.
Another idea might be to contact where you're hoping to go and see if they can facilitate bringing you there and moving things along from the end of where you want to be.
Huh. Okay, with funding?
With funding. I'm thinking of hospice specifically, and that's because that's the world I know, but they'll work with patients that have Medicaid pending applications. And so there might be some possibility on the end of the healthcare system you're trying to get into in the state you're trying to go to that you might find something a little bit more helpful, perhaps.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you. This is a wonderful subject. I'm so glad you're doing it.
Thank you, Wendy. I hope you make the move smoothly.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's all those things, too, Wendy reminds me, that you don't want to have to deal with all the money issues, et cetera, or five different agencies, but sometimes you have to do that. It's a very complicated setup at the end of life. I found that to be. It should be simpler somehow.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. I was a long-distance caregiver for my elderly grandmother, and as a geriatrician, trying to work with contacting her physician, working with the rehab facility where she was located, and trying to allow her to make her choices and have control and autonomy over her decision-making. She wanted to return home and had the decisional capacity to do that. And I was astounded that as a geriatrician, if I couldn't navigate that, how on earth could anybody else?
Exactly. It's your area. Bobby in Waterloo. Hi.
Good morning. It's interesting that the complications that you were just talking about, because one of the things I was going to speak to is my mother-in-law moved here to Wisconsin with us from Florida almost 6 years ago, and she was 85, 86 at the time. She just passed away this past August. We had the help of hospice. We had the help of assisted living. I live in Jefferson County, so I had a social worker and a Care Wisconsin worker who are absolutely fabulous to work with. Hospice was great. But I am working part-time, and I could not have held down a full-time job and done everything that needed to be done. The complexity and the laws and the regulations are just incredible. And I can't say enough good things about the social workers and the help I had here in Jefferson County. They were fabulous.
It is true. There is. Thank you very much, Bobby, for the call. So much to be done. And maybe does it indicate that we need to think about all of this pretty seriously ahead of time so that we know we don't walk into this cold? I think that's one of the things we're learning from the hour. Dr. Kramer?
Well, I think the challenge is, we spoke earlier about the importance of, you know, getting to know our family members and their wishes and all that. And I think that's something all of us, whatever age we are, could be doing. I have conversations with my children. However, I think it gets really tricky trying to anticipate what's going to happen down the road and exactly what it is we'll be dealing with to even know, you know, like in this situation, to be able to look into all the various options. You know, you could call an agency and say, well, you know, what are the possible services that might be available to my mother-in-law
right,
who moves
exactly.
in with us 10 years from now?
Right,
and it's just,
right.
You know, a lot of times you just have to kind of get in there and, you know, when you have specific distinctive issues you're dealing with.
Yeah. Thank you very much, both of you, for being with us. There's still so much more to talk about. We'll put a website up on our Facebook page, too, for the Share the Care program. And that's just the Kathleen Dunn Show at Facebook. Thanks to both our informative guests, Dr. Betty Kramer, Professor, School of Social Work, University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. Stacy Fisher, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Healthcare Policy and Research at the University of Colorado. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and for doing our on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all the help. Tomorrow during this hour, Ron Reagan will be joining us, author of My Father at 100. This is the Ideas Network.